Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of July 24th, 2015. In the basic pyramid of human needs, shelter is right at the bottom. It's a building block of who we are and how we protect ourselves, our kids, and our societies. It's got a pretty strong economic link, too. A lot of what we do with our money, spending it, saving it, trying to grow it, ties into our need for shelter. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Yes, this week's show is about shelter in the physical sense, where we live, where we turn for protection, how we try to make the rent or mortgage payment, and in the broader sense, in, say, financial markets that try to weather bumpy economic moments, or the future of a country when its workers leave to find better jobs somewhere else. You can tell us what provides you with a sense of financial shelter. You know where to find us online, and we like to work your stories into the show. We're at MarketplaceWeekend.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. I mentioned that basic pyramid of human needs. Food, water, clothing, and shelter. Those are right at the bottom, a base for building a life. In this first story, we visit a literal shelter. In the wake of the recession, cities across the country had to respond to increasing homelessness. In Los Angeles, the city recently passed controversial ordinances to crack down on street encampments. In the past 2 years, homelessness in and around LA has gone up by 12%. That's driven largely by unemployment, high rents, and low wages. Skid Row in downtown LA is where a lot of homeless people in the city gather. That's also where the Downtown Women's Center is. They offer help with housing and daytime drop-in programs. Amy Turk is the chief programs officer there. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Run me through the services you guys provide.
Sure. Downtown Women's Center provides permanent supportive housing, medical and mental health services.
What is permanent supportive housing?
We provide permanent housing. So women that live with us sign a lease and they can live there as long as they need to.
And what comes with that?
In addition to the housing and the rental subsidy to make it affordable, we provide supportive services that includes medical and mental health services, access to affordable food.
So about how many people come into the shelter every day? Because you guys have a lot of daytime services, right?
Yes. In the course of a year, we served nearly 4,000 women. 200 a day walk through our services.
What does it look like when you walk inside?
Sure. Our doors open at 6 a.m. in the morning, and many of the women have survived a night out on the streets. And so they're anxious to get in for a warm cup of coffee and to settle in for the day. They are able to rest at our center and put their belongings to the side and have a safe place to be throughout the day before potentially facing another night on the streets.
My producer, Jenny, spoke with a woman, Teresa, who was a cook there, and I want to play some tape from her because she became homeless for the first time at a later age. Let's listen to that.
Okay, we're dropping a few dishes. I'm Teresa. Well, I'm wearing a hairnet, and we're supposed to wear hairnets and our aprons and gloves at all times and serving the participants here breakfast, lunch, and snack at the Women's Center because of safety, you know. I was homeless at one time. I've always been independent. I've always, also too, I have a CNA certificate, so I do in-home care, but I've always had the job, but rent got expensive and till I couldn't afford to where I lived at. So I became homeless. And I don't want to cry, but I rode the bus many a nights, slept in shelters, and then I stayed with my family and my boyfriend. But I just didn't want to be a burden on them. I really didn't. I get clothing here. I never wear the same thing. Never, never, never. I never just seen myself as being homeless at the age that I was. At 55 years old, I just never thought about that.
So, Amy, tell me about the population that lives there or who you see come through on a more transitory basis. How unusual is Teresa's story to be homeless for the first time over the age of 50?
Sadly, Teresa's story is not unusual. Of the women that we serve, 51% are 50 years old and above.
Really?
Absolutely. Many of them have had long careers. Many of them have had marriages and children, and due to many circumstances, have fallen into homelessness.
I want to play some sound from a woman named Pamela, who our producer also met there, talking about sort of the cost of being homeless. Let's play that.
The money, you don't really need money to get into a shelter. You don't need money to do any of those things like missions and shelters, even though some of them are charging. The money comes when you, say for instance, you're on GR and you want an SRO, which is single room occupancy down here. They're rooms in hotels. And you can pay your rent. Sometimes it's $65, sometimes it's $137. I used to pay $137. So it's according to how much you have. You know, Section 8, it's according to how much. It could be 30% of your income or another percentage. But it's according to what you have. Say you have SSI, and you would probably pay $257 a month for a room or for a one-bedroom or for a studio. I live in a studio right now.
Before we get into that, I just want to point out that there are a couple of acronyms she used. GR, SSI, those are for General Relief and Social Security, basically different programs that provide funds. But what does it take to transition to permanent housing? How does that work?
Finding permanent housing is one of the solutions to ending homelessness. Having the income to back it up is also what helps people maintain their housing. So as Pamela has explained, many of the women that come to the Downtown Women's Center have access to General Relief County funding, which is only $221 a month.
I read through kind of a survey of the population that you guys did, and the number one reason that people cited for being homeless was lack of affordable housing.
Absolutely. In L.A. County, there is a lack of affordable housing to the tune of 500,000 units. And
what's the price of affordable housing? What does that mean? That's such a catchphrase. What does it actually mean?
Well, in L.A. County, studies show right now that you need about a salary of about $70,000 a year in order to afford a one-bedroom rental. $70,000 salary.
Wow. That's a whole lot higher than the median income in the U.S.
Absolutely.
How much money would it take, do you think, to move the women who come through your doors into permanent housing?
That's a great question. To house 4,000 women, we're talking a few million.
Does that seem like a pipe dream?
No. I think with advocacy, with awareness raising, we can do some good work to convince people that this needs to happen.
Amy Turk, Chief Programs Officer at Downtown Women's Center. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Elvis Summers also saw increasing homelessness in South Los Angeles, where he lives. When he met 60-year-old Smokey, her real name is Irene McGee, he realized he wanted to do something about the problem himself.
When I moved in here last August, Smokey would come by asking for recyclables. It's kind of the main moneymaker for homeless, you know. So I was like, yeah, no, not a problem. I'll save them for you. So she'd come by a few times a week. You know, every once in a while, I'd just maybe talk to her for a minute, and that was it. But after a few months, I started digging in. I like to get to know people. So I started asking her questions. I started to get to know her, and I knew she slept down the street. But then I asked her one day, I was like, well, exactly. Like, show me. Like, where do you sleep? And I thought she at least had a makeshift, you know, some kind of shelter. She didn't have anything. She had, I mean, not even a cardboard box. She was sleeping in the dirt. I mean, there was just dirt and a broken chair, and that was it. Once I found out that she was just sleeping in the dirt, I guess my mind just kind of snapped. I was like, that's it. You know. So I jumped in the car and I went to Home Depot. After seeing a couple different people building these tiny houses, you know, for the homeless, I saw what they were doing. I was like, that's easy. I could totally do that. And so I just started buying wood. I mean, I kind of looked around at the houses in the neighborhood and just thought smaller. You know, so, I was just, you know, I asked her, too. I was like, you know, well, how'd you feel about if I built you a little house? You know, and it's my favorite answer whenever she's asked, you know, because she just started, you know, laughing. I was like, well, when's it going to be ready? I've built several tiny homes. I mean, I've probably got a couple dozen either out or in the works, more in the works that are almost complete. The smallest ones I have, like Smokey's, cost me $500. Now, again, that was like not knowing anything, not looking for deals, you know, no other resources, you know, $500 for the small ones. I already experimented with a much larger one, and that was around 1,000 to 1,200. The houses are on wheels, and because of the size, I forget offhand, like the maximum size. I think it's the maximum is 10 by 10, but due to the size, and as long as they, you know, they're not plugged up to the electrical grid or have running water, and that they're on wheels, it's not considered a dwelling or a building because it doesn't meet the definition of either. And so it can then be in the street and move every 72 hours, so just like it was a car. So, yeah, I just built her a shelter, and it's just one little piece, you know. Food, water, and shelter, the three basic needs of human life. Always has been, you know, from the days of the cave to now to, you know, all the way in the future. I mean, it's three things we need to survive, period.
Summers has built more than one tiny home for the homeless. You can check out the details on our website, marketplaceweekend.org. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We're focused on the idea of shelter this week. The idea of a tax shelter, it kind of makes me think of that John Grisham book, The Firm, and, you know, offshore bank accounts. But it turns out that personal financial shelters are a little more vanilla and, frankly, more important. To explain, I've got Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst and a friend of the show. Hi, Jill.
Great to be with you.
We're talking about shelters today, and I have to say, the phrase tax shelter sounds kind of, I don't know, dodgy, but I know you're going to explain that it is not, that there are legal and real ways for people to have a tax haven. So what are they?
Well, let's just go back to the root of tax shelter. It's okay. Not nefarious. Everyone relax, okay? It makes it sound like you're setting up an illegal account in the Luxembourg or Liechtenstein or something. So, you know, you go back and you think about the people who worked for, say, a municipality, a teacher, the first kind of retirement plan that they were offered was called a tax-sheltered annuity. And so just think of any employer's plan is a tax shelter, because what you're doing is you're using the IRS code to your advantage. When you put money away for retirement, you get a pre-tax reduction, meaning if I make $100 and I want to put $10 into my 401k, my 403b, my Section 457 plan, my taxable income is reduced by 10. So now the government doesn't tax $100, it taxes $90. The money that I put into that plan is sheltered from taxation until I take it out down the line during retirement. So the best tax shelter is essentially a retirement plan, perfectly legal, and so many of us have them. So it gets a bad rap, that whole tax shelter name.
Yeah. Okay. So why are people so annoyed by tax questions then? I mean, even the numbers you just listed off make my head swim.
Stop it. Come on. It's not that hard, but we do a number on ourselves because we say taxes and we freak ourselves out. So I am not suggesting that you should fall in love with the idea of doing your own taxes, although it's way easier today than it was 25 years ago, frankly, just with software improvements and apps. But that said, this is the kind of thing that becomes emotional and nutty because we have some sort of issue around it and we make ourselves crazy about it. So when you think about sheltering your income, this is a good thing.
So if we're going to talk about tax-effective investing, obviously an employer retirement plan is one way to do it. And a lot of employers make it simple, but what are the other options?
you can always open up a Roth IRA. Now, that is tax preferenced in a different way. So we know that when you put money into a retirement plan and it's an employer-based plan, you put a pre-tax dollar in. Okay, that means it hasn't been taxed yet, right? I put a dollar in and down the line, I'm 59 and a half. When I pull that dollar out, I'm going to have to pay tax on it. It's ordinary income. It's just money that I never paid tax on. So don't complain about, oh, I have $1 million in my IRA. I'm so bummed I have to pay taxes on it. It's never been taxed, okay? And we don't feel bad because you have $1 million. Now, the Roth IRA is slightly different. You put the money in and you don't get any reduction in your income today. So you're putting an after-tax dollar in. So maybe you earned a dollar, but you're only going to be able to put 80 cents in because you have to pay tax on it. However, the 80 cents that goes into the Roth IRA has no tax due at all. So you can invest it, it can grow, and that 80 cents can turn into $80. When you take it out upon retirement, there will be no tax due. So it has been sheltered, all the growth of that 80 cents all the way for many, many years to come is essentially sheltered from taxation. That growth in a traditional IRA or a 401k or a 403b, that accumulation is taxed down the line. So also a tax shelter. You know, it's a great tax shelter in many ways, or a tax preference vehicle, a Section 529 plan. You put money
college
in
savings.
You're going to save for college, right? We got kids. Lizzie and I are married. We decide we have little kids. We want to put money away for our kids. If we put that money into a general investment account and our kids go to Brown University in 20 years and we pull the money out, any money that we make from our investments is going to be taxed. When you use a Section 529 plan, we put after-tax dollars in, but all that accumulation is not taxed as long as we use that money for qualified education costs. So that's also a fantastic tax-preferenced vehicle.
You know, when we talk about shelter and investment, everything is sort of a calculation between risk and safety. And to get a little philosophical about this, can you build an impenetrable shelter when you're investing, or is that the nature of the beast that you can't?
You know, I think it's a Faustian bargain when you become an investor, because it's not as if you assume risk and therefore you will make money. What you are doing is you assume risk for the potential to make money. If you are someone who says, oh my God, I just can never live through the high highs and the low lows again. I want simplicity. I want safety. That safety comes at a cost. And that cost is going to be growth. So there is, even if you think it's the safest investment in the world, and it, you know, could be a U.S. government bond, it can be a CD, that is safe, but there's risk in that as well, which is it's not growing, and therefore it may not keep pace with inflation. And therefore, in order for me to be super ultra safe, I have to accept that it's going to require me to save more money because my money's not going to grow. So I've got to save even more money. But you're absolutely right. Risk and reward, that's it. Your every single financial decision, there's risk and reward. You know, I think about it sometimes in insurance, okay?
Okay.
When I drive my car, I have to carry insurance, right? I don't want to retain the risk myself of if I got into a car accident and something bad happened, I want to pay somebody to assume that risk for me, right? Now, I don't go through every year and say, oh, what a bummer. I didn't get into an accident. I threw my insurance money away. I am willing to make that transfer of risk. I'm willing to pay the insurance company to take the risk for me. Somehow in investing, we sort of lose that. We lose that thread. You can't grumble that you've had rotten returns, or I've only been in CDs for the last 5 years and the market's tripled and I haven't been there. You can't complain about that if you've said to somebody or yourself, I can't handle risk. Everything is a trade-off.
Jill Schlesinger is a CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. As always, thank you.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
We're going to move now from personal financial shelters to, well, something that acts as a financial shelter in markets and in economies, as a hedge against inflation or the apocalypse. And that is gold. Gold even showed up on Donald Trump's financial disclosure forms this week. And gold's been having a rough summer. Its price is down $100 since May, meaning that people aren't really using it like a classic shelter right now. Our resident explainer, Patty Hirsch, is here to tell us why. Welcome back, Patty.
Hi, Lizzie.
All right, so why is gold taking such a beating? I mean, you know, that means even Donald Trump's holdings get hurt. Does no one think gold is an attractive option anymore?
Well, apparently not the Chinese, right? A lot of the turbulence in the gold market this week has come because China revealed that it's got far less gold in its central bank reserves than people thought. And also because a Chinese investor was rumored to have dumped a very large amount of gold onto the market on Monday.
So that, of course, would depress prices. Do all of the issues stem to China, though?
No, not at all. It's popular to blame China for all the world's woes right now, of course. But China's playing only a small part in gold's demise this year. Of course, gold, right, is a safe haven, right? So if you live
right,
in
a shelter, if you will.
So if you live in a scary place, right, you buy gold as a store of wealth for when things go bad, which is one of the reasons why women in certain parts of the world buy so much gold jewelry, right? They literally carry around their bank accounts. And for a while there, during the financial crisis, the entire world was this really, really scary place, which is why gold was so popular with everybody from Kazakh matrons to British hedge fund managers.
But, I mean, with the possible exception of Greece, the world is far less scary now.
Well, yeah, certain parts of it, yes. I mean, obviously, I can't speak for Kazakhstan, obviously, but the US is certainly less scary. Inflation is only growing very sluggishly here. You talk about Greece, but Europe is less scary too, now that the Greeks and the European Central Bank appear to be working on some kind of a solution to their problems. Even the Middle East looks less scary, thanks to this deal recently done with Iran. So investors don't feel the need to hold on to gold in the way that they might have in the past.
Well, that gets to the sort of gut level question here and fear. Mm. But is there more to it? I mean, it can't just be that, OK, we're feeling a little bit better about the global economy.
No, I'm afraid it's not just exciting stuff like fear and greed. It's also about really boring stuff like interest rates and the strength of the dollar. So, you know, let's talk about the dollar first. As we all know, the dollar is very strong right now. But what you may not know is that gold is priced in dollars, which means that as the dollar has risen, so you get less gold for your buck. And that has really cut into demand, not just for gold, but in fact, all commodities priced in dollars. So let's talk about interest rates now. Well, it looks as though we're going to see rates go up this year. And that's going to make things that have interest rates, like bonds and mortgages, more popular. People are going to want to buy more of those things. But it's going to make things that don't have interest rates, like gold, less popular. So investors are already getting ready for that by selling gold now rather than waiting for the inevitable.
So if you own gold, you're invested in it, or you know, you're just kind of like most of us wondering, like, well, what happens next? How bad could this get?
Well, Lizzie, I'm not going to speculate because that'd get me into trouble. But
other people do.
But a lot of analysts are. That's their job, right? And a lot of them are betting that gold is going to go lower, maybe below $1,000 an ounce. And remember, gold was trading at $1,600 an ounce just a few years ago. But the world is a very uncertain place, and bad things that can happen that can change investor perception very, very quickly. China is still struggling a bit, so I keep an eye on that. Europe remains a concern. I mean, if things go into reverse with the Greeks, or if the UK decides to leave the European Union, that would certainly frighten people. And then there are the really big shocks, like a strategically significant war or maybe a terrorist attack on US soil. Those are the kinds of things that can throw the entire world off its axis and make gold very popular again very quickly.
You know, Patty, I'd like you to explain sort of the two different ways that people own gold, because what we saw in Donald Trump's financial disclosure, very unusual, he actually owns the stuff. But most people who buy gold do it through an exchange-traded fund or something that mirrors the price of gold. Can you just, in layman's terms, tell us how that works?
Yeah, well, so some people will buy physical gold, right? I mean, like, for example, your ladies in Kazakhstan have got it draped around their necks, and Donald Trump, who may have it, like, stuffed under his floorboard somewhere. I don't know. But yeah, you're right. Most people buy it in these things called exchange-traded funds. And what that means is they're giving money to a hedge fund manager or a fund manager of some kind who is then buying gold or in quite often buying gold mine stocks or things related to gold, and then watching the progress of that gold go up and down, and that drives the price of the shares that you buy up and down. So you haven't actually bought gold if you bought an ETF. You bought something related to gold, and it means that those shares will move up and down on an index in kind of conjunction in the way that the gold actually moves. So you haven't actually bought gold itself. You can't actually go out and sell those shares in your ETF thinking that they're gold. They're related to the price of gold, but they're not actually gold itself.
Perfect explanation from Patty Hirsch, our resident marketplace explainer. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
And if you want to know more about exchange-traded funds, Patty has got a marketplace video explainer on those. Just go to marketplace.org/whiteboard. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Our next story, well, the shelter connection is pretty obvious. We're talking about a game with the name Fallout Shelter. You play it on your phone. But here's the thing. Fallout Shelter is actually just an app designed to drum up excitement for a different game. A console game that's the next in the Fallout series from game maker Bethesda. But the trailer app, Fallout Shelter, suddenly shot to popularity, making $5 million in 2 weeks. Joshua Brustein wrote about it for Bloomberg Business. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The title of this article is pretty great. It's How This App Accidentally Made $5 Million in 2 Weeks, which just seems a little bananas.
Yeah, absolutely. We all want to accidentally make $5 million, right?
Yeah, I'd be done. I'd be out of here. Like, you can host the show. What happened and how did Fallout Shelter make $5 million?
Sure. So Fallout Shelter is an app that was essentially meant to promote the next game in the Fallout series, which comes out later this year for gaming consoles. And it was basically kind of, here's something to keep you guys excited in the next couple of months. What it actually looks like is kind of a post-apocalyptic ant farm. Your job is to create a nuclear fallout shelter. And so you sort of go in and you start with one room, and then you'll add another room, maybe a room where you're making power or making food, or a bedroom where you'll make more residents for your fallout shelter, and you just sort of build it up over time. And they were not trying to necessarily make any money, but they did put in the ability to buy your way to quicker progress through the game.
So I want to get into the nitty-gritty of this, but it's sort of as if a movie trailer, not even the movie, suddenly made a lot of money.
That's exactly what it's like.
Why has this thing done so well? I mean, it's like a little cartoon trailer, but it's up there rivaling, you know, Candy Crush, Flappy Bird, the other things that took off.
Yeah, well, sort of really lightweight games tend to do well on mobile devices. It's something that you can play sort of quick. The other reason it did really well is because Fallout is very popular. They made a big announcement, and it just kind of took off. One thing that's interesting is it kind of took off for about 2 or 3 weeks, and people are starting to very clearly get bored of it. There's charts that show how much has been downloaded and how much money people are spending, and it really started to go down pretty quickly after about 2 weeks.
This gets into this question of freemium, which is a ridiculous word, but you can download the game for free and yet do a little better if you actually purchase, what, a lunchbox?
It's called a lunchbox. Yeah, this is basically how all mobile games nowadays make money. You can play a little bit for free, and then you reach a point where it starts getting kind of hard, and you can either wait a long time or get stuck completely, or you can purchase a little help. And in this case, it's called a lunchbox, and it gives you kind of the resources you need to move to the next level to, you know, build extra things within your shelter.
What does that tell you about the economic model for games, particularly on mobile, going forward?
Yeah, so this has been the way to make money on games, on mobile devices. You mentioned Candy Crush. That's how it works. Clash of Clans, the other kind of monster of the mobile gaming market. It's free to play. You can play for a while, but eventually you're going to be pretty tempted to buy something or another. And the interesting thing with Fallout is this is very different from the way that developers like Bethesda, who makes Fallout, make money. They're used to selling games for $60, and that's that. The stereotype is that sort of aggressive young men play the PC and console games, and that middle-aged women play games on their mobile devices. That's never completely been true. And what we've seen here is that if you make the right kind of game, you're going to get a lot of the console audience to go ahead and play a game on their smartphone, because why wouldn't they do that too?
Joshua Brustein is a writer for Bloomberg Business. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We're focused on shelter in today's show, but we're going to take a short break from that and look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. You can find them all at Marketplace's By the Numbers blog at marketplace.org. And it's great. You should really check it out. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe. Tony?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
37 million.
That's how many users are on Ashley Madison,
a website that helps cheating spouses arrange affairs.
The site was hacked this week by a group calling itself the Impact Team.
The hackers are demanding the site be taken down. If not, they'll say they'll release the private information of all Ashley Madison users.
1.2 billion.
That's how much Toshiba has claimed in false profits over the last 6 years.
When news broke of the scandal, several executives resigned, including CEO Hisao Tanaka.
4,000 species.
That's how many species of cockroaches exist. Pause to let that sink in.
It's a pretty disturbing number for anyone who has shrieked at the sight of our skittering little friends.
But a zoo in Japan is hoping to rebrand the cockroach.
They're opening an exhibit that highlights the important role cockroaches play in the natural world.
Now a question of shelter that touches on economics, politics, and social policy. This week, the Republican-led House voted to take away federal money from so-called sanctuary cities, a measure that's unlikely to become law. These cities are places where local officials and law enforcement don't always comply with federal immigration law. The issue popped back up again after a young woman in San Francisco was murdered, allegedly by an undocumented immigrant who had been released by local authorities. That's led to hearings on Capitol Hill and a lot of commentary in the 2016 presidential race. We wanted to look underneath the rhetoric to the economics of how and why cities and states decided to go their own way on some immigration issues. First, we sent producer Raghu Manavalan to get this view of what it's like to live undocumented in Los Angeles.
My name is Jasmine. I've lived 15 years. I used to live in Acapulco, Mexico.
Are you an undocumented immigrant or documented?
Undocumented. Since I've been living here, I went to school first, and then after I was done with high school, I started working. So far, I would like to think that it's been a positive experience from my part, giving back to the economy. I like to think. From my personal opinion, I would like to say that if you just want to come and work and make a living, you should be able to. I mean, it's not like you're asking for anything for free. You know, you're actually going out there, finding a job, and making your own honest money. Granted, maybe you enter the country in a way that is not so honest, but it's not because you wanted to, you know? So, yeah, I like to think that if you are willing to put in the effort, you should be able to get some kind of, not reward, but, you know, whatever it's due to you.
Now, to talk about how economics shaped this issue and how states and cities develop these so-called sanctuary city policies, we have Manuel Pastor. He's the director of the USC Center for Immigrant Integration. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Glad to be with you.
So I gather that the term sanctuary city is A, controversial, and B, something that you think is a little bit of a misnomer. Can you explain that to me?
The term sanctuary city actually comes out of a movement in the 1980s during the wars in Central America, in which numerous municipalities and actually a lot of folks in the faith community wanted to have their municipalities declared to be sanctuary cities, that is, places where political refugees from those wars could be safe from removal by immigration authorities. What's going on now is not a sort of political declaration or shielding of political refugees. It's actually more of a commitment to community policing, and actually more secure communities. And the reason why this is done is because there's a principle of community policing at stake. And that principle is that when people are fearful that their immigration status is going to be picked up on and reported by the police to immigration's authorities, then you're not going to get the kind of cooperation that you need. Someone in the community is not going to report a crime because they're fearful that they're going to be asked about their own status. Someone who has domestic violence committed against them is not going to report their husband because they may want their husband kind of punished by criminal authorities, but they don't necessarily want the family broken up by deportation. And people who are caught up in something like a DUI, if they get deported, that will make the entire community sort of fearful about cooperating with the police. So it's been a pretty standard practice for those committed to community policing to sort of decouple enforcement of immigration law from enforcement of criminal law.
You know, one of the things that I find the most interesting about this debate is that you have cities, particularly large cities in California and other places with large immigrant populations, essentially saying to the federal government, thanks but no thanks, the economics don't work out for us here. You know, we're not interested in enforcing what ICE would like us to enforce.
The kind of striking thing, but that lack of cooperation with ICE has come because the San Francisco police in many major urban areas around the United States are trying to secure the support and cooperation of every resident in their city. And they essentially believe that, again, a thanks but no thanks approach to what ICE is asking is the best way to establish that kind of trust, the best way to do good community policing, the best way to make their city safe.
You know, ICE would counter, though, that in 2008, I think it's something around 38-40% of people deported from the country had a criminal conviction. And now they say, as of last year, that figure had risen to 85%. So they seem to be saying that they are focusing their efforts. In some cases, that would seem like, hey, maybe local jurisdictions should actually interact with them more to provide that information.
In the last several years in particular, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement has done a better job of picking up undocumented immigrants. They still wind up in situations where they're disrupting families, picking people up for very minor infractions, etc. But they have done a better job of prioritizing their enforcement on people who have been convicted of crimes. So kudos to them for shifting their enforcement in that direction.
I want you to explain a little bit more about how money, particularly from the undocumented community, moves through a city or a local economy, because I think that's something that a lot of listeners have a hard time getting their head around. People maybe think of remittances to a home country, but that's it.
Yes, it's clear that when people think about undocumented workers, they're thinking they're sending all their money home. But of course, they're spending money in the country. Important thing for listeners to understand, the sort of size of the undocumented immigrant community has not grown over the last 4 or 5 years. It's really stabilized. There's not as many undocumented immigrants actually coming into the country. And so as a result, we're getting much more established, sort of really woven into the fabric of society. And so they're really contributing to economic life. Interesting thing.
Can you give me numbers about this contribution?
So in the state of California, for example, undocumented immigrants are responsible for about $130 billion of state GDP in terms of what they produce and spend. That's about $45 billion just here in Los Angeles County. The interesting thing, though, is that if you think about the fiscal gains and losses, it turns out that the gains from undocumented immigrant workers actually accrue mostly to the federal level because they pay income taxes, they pay into Social Security but never collect, and a lot of those are sort of net fiscal gains for the federal government. Where the costs really occur are at a local level. The costs in terms of educating the children of the undocumented, sometimes things like in the state of California, we're expanding health insurance to include the children of undocumented. That's obviously a cost that the state is taking on and is willing to take on. So there's a sort of...
Do we know the numbers on that?
Well, In the year to come, the state's going to spend about $40 billion on insuring undocumented children. And that's probably going to cover 200,000 children who didn't have health insurance before. There's also monies that the state spends on covering the U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants as they fall below a certain poverty level. Something that's really interesting is if you look at in places that have a lot of immigrants, Los Angeles, San Francisco, California, New York, those are all the places that are siding with the administration in this lawsuit in Texas to try to have deferred action for parents actually implemented to try to not cooperate with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Because at a local level, they're seeing these immigrants as part of the fabric of their communities. They're seeing the benefits of not scaring people off from cooperating with the police. They're seeing the economic benefits.
Manuel Pastor is director of the USC Center for the Study of Immigrant Integration. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Next, we have a story about two kinds of shelter, housing and asylum. Daniyar Aynetdinov came to the U.S. from Russia on an exchange program. He was studying to be a petroleum engineer. He's also gay, and in the past few years, Russia has instituted new anti-gay laws. He came to the U.S. 6 years ago, but was granted asylum this year. He's lived in just about every situation imaginable. We caught up with him in his current home, a rented room in Los Angeles.
I found this place on a Craigslist, and it was only like $500 in Silver Lake. I'm like, damn, I need to get it. So when I showed up, they had like audition people. So it was like 40 applicants to get this. And then the dog didn't bark on me. And then they're like, oh, the dog likes him more. So they got me this apartment. So yeah. I've been living in LA for 4 years. When you taste freedom, it's hard to go back into the cage. So when you live in a cage, that's all you know. It's just all you know. So you don't know, like, you can speak, you don't know you can be treated fairly no matter, like, who you are. And I was not openly gay back then yet. So no way, I cannot stay there. And I went to the United States and stayed here. When you're an immigrant, you move to the United States, it's very challenging and it's getting very emotionally because it's everything new, the culture is different. For me, being from Russia, I couldn't like hang out with Russian people because that's where like escape from, so I don't want to associate with it. But I couldn't relate to Americans as well because it's just different culture. I thought that like Americans eat out too much and people enjoy food. For me, it was I never ate out ever. So it was very different when people talked about food like 4 hours. Oh, what are we going to eat? We're going to eat this and this and this. Oh, no, not this. I like Italian. Oh, I like French. Mexican's better. It seemed ridiculous to me because I just want to eat whatever is there to kind of fulfill myself. I didn't care just to survive. So it was such a different perspective on that. That's my diary when I was a kid. And I wrote here, like, oh, it's Russia. It's in college, and we had a class, and they asked us, what do you want to achieve? And I said, like, oh, I want to be an actor in Los Angeles. Покорить Голливуд. Like, when I see it all in perspective, it's insane. Insane. It took me 27 years to be myself.
This next story is about seeking economic shelter. 4 years ago, Portugal got a financial bailout from Europe. There was high unemployment, cuts to government services, and many Portuguese left to get jobs abroad. Portugal's economy has now started to grow again, but those workers are skeptical about going back. The BBC's Edwin Lane has the story.
4 years ago, when Portugal's 78 billion euro bailout forced deep cuts to public spending, the Prime Minister, Pedro Passos Coelho, told the country's youth to leave and find jobs elsewhere. Since then, hundreds of thousands have done just that, marking the biggest exodus in workers from Portugal's shores in its recent history. Patricia Freire is a nurse and one of the hundreds of recent nursing graduates who've moved from their homes in Portugal to pursue their career abroad in the UK's National Health Service.
When you tell your someone that you just meet in the street, if you say, I'm studying nursing, they will say, okay, so you will need to move after your degree. So once I started my degree, me and my colleagues were already starting to discuss that we're about England. Do we want to live and to work? You really miss your family and your country, but you know that you made the best choice if you want to be professionally satisfied.
In the last 4 years alone, an estimated 400,000 people have left Portugal in search of work, many of them skilled and educated. And there are fears over the impact that is having on an economy still recovering from years of austerity. Francisco Lussa is a well-known Portuguese economist and former politician.
Almost 6% of the workforce of Portugal emigrated in the last 4 years. And that's a tragedy because it's mostly young people, very well trained, qualified engineers, medical doctors, nurses and so on, going to Britain, to Germany, to France, wherever they can live. So Portugal is losing a lot. It's a way of subsidizing other countries as well, because if an engineer is trained at a faculty in Portugal and goes to Germany, we are paying Germany for their work. Of course, in Europe there's a lot of movement of people, and that's a very good thing. But when the movement is only from the poor countries to the richer countries, it will increase the inequality.
Here in Portugal's capital, Lisbon, the impact of austerity is still being keenly felt. But despite that, there are signs of optimism. The economy is slowly growing again, and businesses say emigration means Portugal now has a large pool of workers with the language skills and the experience abroad needed to rebuild the economy.
So is Portugal likely to reverse the brain drain? Cláudia Pereira is a researcher at the Emigration Observatory at the University of Lisbon.
Many of the Portuguese will not come back because they are there for 3-4 years. They are already gaining roots in the foreign countries. So Portugal will have to have much more job offers and much more good conditions. When they start having kids or getting married abroad, they will not come back unless they have a very good economy in the home country. Ireland did it in the 90s, but it's an exception.
Back in the UK, nurse Patricia Freire is missing home. But after just 18 months, she says she's already laying the foundations for her new life. The economy's showing signs of improving in Portugal. Are you tempted to go back?
No. No, because I know that even if it gets better and better, I don't believe it will become the country where I want to work. Of course, it's a country that I want to live, but that's not all that you need in your life. We started to realize that we are making our life in here. I'm always missing Portugal, but not as my house, but as a place to go for holidays. So I think England is becoming my house now.
And that's our show for this week. Remember last week's show when we talked about the need to take vacations? Well, for the next 2 weeks, I am taking our show up on our advice. So next week, we're taking the show to San Francisco, where Marketplace's Molly Wood will take the reins. She'll be exploring robots, the economy, and you. Our show is produced by Jenny Ament and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.